You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the latest episode of the City of Man podcast. This is Ed Song. I teach in the philosophy department at Westmont College in Santa Barbara, California. With me, as always, is Professor Coyle Neal, who teaches in the political science department at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. How are you today, Coyle?
I'm doing all right. I'm getting over a little bit of a cold, or hopefully getting over a little bit of a cold, but other than that, fine.
Oh, really? This isn't that the flu that's going around,
No,
is it?
No. If it is, it's like the pansy flu. I mean, it's. I think it's just a cold.
And is it spreading through the whole Neal household, or is it just?
Well, it's hit at least one of my kids, maybe both of them, and they gave it to me because, of course, when you're 3 years old, you have to cough, sneeze, and shout into your daddy's face whenever you possibly can. So
yeah, those little buggers are cute, but they are disease vectors.
Yeah, I mean, you just put it on the list of the things that you punish them for when they're old enough to understand. And
I do think, though, that like every time a child gets sick before the age of five, buys them two free passes of health later on in life. When we first moved to Louisiana, and so it's always hard when you move to a new region because I know your guests, you're exposed to like different germ variations.
Sure.
But like Hannah was, I don't know, two or something like that. And we moved there. And she started into daycare, at least part-time when we moved down there. And so she was getting sick like every 2 weeks, and it was just miserable for that first year, like that first year in Baton Rouge. And then she got like all the crazy kids' diseases that you get, like, what is it? Is it hoof and mouth?
Right.
And then there's like fifth disease. There are like all these weird childhood diseases that kids only get that are like, you get rashes and like high fever.
Right.
She got like every single one of those. But then like now she just never gets sick. Never gets sick.
Yeah. So I hope they're never getting sick means that eventually I will also never get sick.
Yeah. Parents is a different story. But in any case, our topic today is states' rights. And I'm actually particularly eager to get to it today. Regular listeners to our program are familiar to hearing Coyle and I joust on a whole variety of different issues. And then I kind of always find that whatever the issue is, as we push deeper and deeper into whatever we're talking about, over and over again, states' rights kind of figures. And I think in some ways it gets at the most fundamental normative commitment that lies at the heart of the way that you, Coyle, think about politics, or at least like the sources of our disagreement.
Yeah, it might be close anyway. I don't know that it's quite at the heart. I don't know. I don't know that I have a really full, well-developed political philosophy, which is terrible for someone who both teaches and has a podcast. It might be republicanism, right? Small r, that's at the heart of it, but certainly not unrelated to what we're talking about today.
Yeah. But, you know, I mean, it's interesting. I don't think you talked much directly. I haven't gone back and listened to it. But like some of the first episodes that we did were just on conservatism and liberalism. And I don't know that states' rights figured very much in those very early conservatism episodes. But I kind of think that more than anything else, you're a states' rights conservative. This is actually something I've been thinking about a lot these days for a lot of different reasons. But like the different ways in which a person could formulate or explain a commitment to states' rights, what might be attractive about it, and then what I kind of think is problematic about it. So, Coyle, maybe you can kick us off just by saying what states' rights doctrine is, and then talking a little bit about its history and development in the American Constitution.
Yeah, I mean, so what is states' rights is a complicated question in the same way as, you know, what is conservatism or what is liberalism, and that it's a big doctrine. And I suspect just to you pointed out that I didn't talk a whole lot about it when we were talking conservatism. You do not have to be a conservative to believe in states' rights. I think it happens more often. It certainly happens more often than you are. But you certainly don't have to be. But as far as what states' rights is in the American context, which it's not the only context this idea exists, but it's certainly the primary one our listeners are going to be used to, and it's the one where it's probably the most time is spent thinking about it. It's a sort of acknowledgement. So states' rights is an acknowledgement of a tension that's built into our government by the principle of federalism, where we have these two mostly non-overlapping layers of government operating legitimately in one nation. That combined with the idea that each layer of government, both the federal government and the state government, ought to be protected from invasion by the other layer into its proper sphere of operation. So states' rights is in some ways it's a militant policing of that legitimate line between those two governments, between those two different governments. And hopefully by phrasing it that way, I'm pulling it back a little bit from the conservative liberal debate. I hope that in putting it that way, you can see how one could be a liberal and say, yeah, that's a thing, even if most of them mm-hmm. don't.
Yeah, in fact, to foreshadow one of the questions that I have, I mean, one question is whether or not this is a liberal view. I actually think it is a liberal
view. I mean, it's certainly a liberal view, like small L liberal. I mean, you don't.
I suppose
there are some kinds of connections to, you know, old school feudalism, but I mean they're only incidental. They're not meaningful in any way. Was that enough of a definition, Ed, or do we need more?
Perfect. You want to talk about how that state's rights doctrine is enshrined in the American Constitution?
Yeah, so states' rights is a cornerstone of the Constitution and one of the reasons for the Revolution. Not the only reason, of course. You know, there's taxation without representation and so on. But it exists side by side with the fact that states, you know, previously colonies, have always been under a larger authority. Right? So before they were under the Constitution, they were under the Continental Congress, the Articles of Confederation, and before that, they were under the authority of Parliament. So one of the reasons for revolution was the protecting the integrity of colonial governments against intrusion by Parliament. That's a tension that exists alongside the fact that Parliament was the legitimate authority. And that tension has just always been there in our history. Another aspect of the Constitution is that it sets up a federal government that only has expressly granted powers. Those powers themselves are very limited. Not as limited as they were under the Articles of Confederation, certainly far more limited than most other Western style governments. So relative to, you know, the British government or the French government, I mean, I'm no expert on Western European governments, but from what I understand, the American government doesn't have nearly as much power as those governments do. States, so that's the federal government. States, by contrast, have plenary powers. That is, they are only limited either by specific provisions of the Constitution. That we see in places like Article 1, Article 4, the 13th to the 15th Amendment, and so on. Or state power is limited by voluntary self-restraint in their own constitutions and codes. So again, there's this divide between the federal government as a intentionally heavily limited government and state governments that can basically do whatever they want. And again, this is written intentionally into the Constitution. And then another idea that has to be kept in mind when we're thinking about states' rights are the ideas of sovereignty and legitimacy. Since the 1600s in the Western world, sovereignty and legitimacy, you know, the power to rule and the right to rule, they've been measured by their reflection of and their responsiveness to the people, not by divine right and not by their practical effectiveness. In a nation the size of the United States, whether the size of the United States in the 1780s or the size of the United States in the 21st century, that has to mean that primary and fundamental sovereignty legitimacy happen not at the national level, but with the governments that are closest to the people. The farther from the people a government is, the more legitimate sovereignty has to be supplanted, and the states' rights. People will generally argue that this legitimate sovereignty will not only be supplanted, but it will eventually be replaced with coercion and power. And yet we all recognize the sovereignty of the federal government as well. Right. So again, there's that tension of close to the people is more sovereign and more legitimate, farther away, and you have to have a stronger and stronger and stronger government. But that far away government is still sovereign and legitimate. Two terms that will get bandied around by the true devotees of states' rights, nullification and interposition. So sometimes these terms are just used interchangeably. Sometimes they're not. The fact that the states' rights crowd has regularly lost, I think, means that there's not really a systematic approach to it, right? There's not one overarching worldview or philosophy or constitutional interpretation or whatever that you can latch onto, which means that the terms get a little confused. Nullification is the idea that a state can veto a federal action, at least within its own borders. Veto is probably not the right word. That might be more of a technical word. Ignore a federal action, I guess. Refuse to comply with a federal action, something like that. The word interposition can be used like that. So it can be used just as the equivalent of nullification. Or it can mean the idea that a group of states can get together and veto a federal action. Be it within their borders or sort of an overall veto on, you know, a law passed by Congress or a presidential action or whatever. And, you know, again, that just depends on which states' rights thinker you're reading as to what definition they use for which term. And then within that idea of groups of states vetoing federal actions, there's going to be disagreement over how many states are necessary. Should it be 51% of the states can veto a federal action, or maybe just a largish minority? You know, today, you know, 30 out of 50, or 9 out of 13 back in the early republic or what have you. So yeah, all obviously a lot of stuff to keep in mind. Ed, I've been rambling. Anything to add about any of that?
Yeah, no, I think that's a pretty good overview. I guess one question that I have is what is the normative foundation for this view? Like, what's the justification for this view? And that kind of gets to like this question that I asked earlier, like, is this a liberal view? And by liberal, I just mean liberal in that broadest, most fundamental sense. So not liberal in the sense of progressive.
Right.
But liberal in the sense of rooted in a political morality that kind of begins with or prioritizes this idea that individual persons have by nature certain kinds of rights and liberties that define the limits of state power and that deserve respect. And so, you know, so even just talking about states' rights, it's states' rights, right?
Yeah, in that small L sense, absolutely, right? In the American context, you could argue that it is mostly liberal with a kind of uniquely what's the right way to say this? I hesitate to say Christian spin because that's going to have implications that I don't want to make. Let's say dominantly liberal view with some ecclesiological ideas stolen from Christianity. Right.
Something about that.
Again, small L liberal. I mean, that's going to apply to England. That's going to apply to Germany. That's going to apply to France and America and so on. But America with the religious aspect of so much of our colonial era, how much it was dominated by a particular kind of Protestant Christianity, with a very particular ecclesiology, right? The idea of a church. Whether a church synod or an independent congregation, whether you're talking, you know, Presbyterians or Congregationalists, having very specific ideas about the rights of a local church body that gets translated into government and translated into government fairly intentionally. So it is liberal. It is, you know, small L liberal. But the structures are at least affected by some of our Christian background.
Mm-hmm. I guess I should just note here that so certainly in the story of the American founding, pretty clearly has that liberal political morality lineage, though there are probably other alternative ways of trying to provide a normative foundation for the ideal. So, I mean, you know, one idea that comes up in a lot of these conversations in some of the articles that you sent me is just like the idea of subsidiarity. Right, which is this Roman Catholic doctrine that also gets developed by a lot of neo-Calvinist political theologians like Kuyper. that's a related idea. But the idea of subsidiarity is that it recognizes that there is a kind of a natural ordering to social life, from the level of the family to civil society, all the way up to the state, that there are all these different, you know, spheres of human life. And as part of this nature of this structure is that issues are always best resolved in the sphere in which those issues arise.
Right.
So education, for example, is an issue that arises in the sphere of the family. And it's only when failures happen that other spheres of human life can step in and try to remediate and address
it. And maybe not even then, right? I mean, you're right that both sort of states' rights proper, I guess we want to say that, and then the subsidiarity theory, which is pretty closely related and often held by, you know, the same people. They both say, you know, most things should be dealt with by local and state governments, right? As close as possible to the people. Of the things that cannot be dealt with locally, there are basically two categories of that. So some of those things should be dealt with by the higher authority, you know, the federal government in the American context. I assume the church structure in the Roman Catholic context, or I don't know have the right words to use there, but the magisterium, I guess. Some things in political context, you might say, you know, the military, that's something that can't ultimately be handled locally. That needs national coordination. The post office is something that can't be handled locally. That needs national coordination. But then there are also things that you might say, yeah, this can't be handled locally. And it's a genuine social ill that it can't be handled locally. But that doesn't matter. If it can't be handled locally, it ought not be handled at all.
Okay, well, so can you give me an example?
Right. So there are certainly the more libertarian minded out there who might use welfare as an example.
Yeah. I would say that I don't think of libertarians as being people who are into subsidiarity, at least that kind of libertarian. I mean, the reason why there shouldn't be federal taxation for the libertarian to deal with welfare issues is because they think that's theft.
That's true. And I probably shouldn't have said libertarians, right?
I guess I just note that little bit of disagreement just because like you don't often hear, at least the subsidiarity theorists who the way that I think about subsidiarity theorists and like the ones that I've read talk about no-go zones for higher level sphere intervention.
Right.
It more is sort of this picture that like, when there are failures at lower levels, that just gets picked up at higher levels as they are able to address them. Not that, in addition to that, there are some issues that should, even if they could be addressed by higher level spheres, that they shouldn't be addressed
right.
by higher level spheres.
Yeah, so I haven't followed up on this, but I assume that they still can't drink the water in Flint, Michigan. I don't keep up with all the states' rights and subsidiarity guys out there, but I assume that that would be an example of something that they would look at and say, look, that's a terrible situation, but it's not something that it would be proper for the federal government to step in and involve itself. It's something that needs to be dealt with locally. And if it's not dealt with locally, that's very unfortunate for the people of Flint, but that's not the job of the federal government. And we don't want to see them taking on that function.
Yeah, I don't know that you hear subsidiarity theorists. I don't think that's a part of classic subsidiarity theory. It's more that like always should be dealt with at the level closest to the nature of the problem. If it can't be addressed at that level, then it should be addressed at a higher level.
Right, that's true.
Like because that gets at the responsibility of these various different spheres. Like these spheres really do have real responsibilities that they're supposed to discharge.
Right.
And when a sphere doesn't have the ability to discharge that responsibility, that sort of it rightly goes up to the higher level to fulfill its responsibility.
Right. No. And again, the hesitation that I have is that not everything goes up to the next level. And again, there's disagreement over what does and what doesn't. But I shouldn't say no subsidiarity theorists, because again, I'm not familiar enough with all of the writers out there, but. From what I understand, yeah, there are some things that don't get kicked up. Otherwise, you know, every time you have a local government failure, just expand the power of the federal government, and would ultimately defeat the purpose of subsidiarity in the first place.
I'm trying to decide if we should come back to this later or tackle it now. So again, I'll just note that like that's not the way that like the classic subsidiarity theorists handle it. And one reason why, I mean, so like the Flint, Michigan debate is in some ways a good example. So let's just say it's the case that local and state authorities, for whatever reason, cannot remediate the problem on their own, and the federal government can. And then let's say the subsidiarity theorist says, yeah, so it could fix the problem, but it shouldn't fix the problem. And so these people are just condemned to drink bad water. So now I guess the question is, like, what's the moral justification for the fact that this entity could solve the problem but shouldn't solve the problem? Like, why is the welfare of the people living in that community less important than everybody staying in their lane?
Well, and it comes back to that idea that there is a legitimate boundary between these layers of government. That boundary matters for purposes of both sovereignty and legitimacy, matters for purposes of liberty, which we haven't really talked as much about. And it matters for purposes of the integrity of things like state and local governments. Maybe it's great if the federal government steps in and fixes the water problem in Flint, Michigan. It certainly undermines that local government's ability to solve its own problems. It's not necessarily doing them any long-term favors in solving their problem for them, even if it is a legitimate benefit in the short run.
Well, this, of course, is assuming that they can't solve the problem.
Well, yeah, of course. Yeah, we're assuming.
Wait, so, and a couple things. Like, so you just deferred back to liberal talk there, right? And yes. So you deferred back to sovereignty and legitimacy talk. Like, that's not subsidiarity talk. So again, like, I don't think that resistance to expansion to other spheres is a part of subsidiarity talk. Like, that's, I mean, you don't see that in the classic Dutch subsidiarity theorists or in the Roman Catholic social theorists.
And again, I'm not familiar enough with the ins and outs of them to want to dig into that too much. So, sure, I'll agree with you on this one, Ed. I'll agree.
Well, in some ways, that's an issue that I want to come back to, like why those concerns about legitimacy say trump other kinds of moral concerns that we have.
Right.
But then, you know, but all of this is to say that so you have states' rights talk. One of the chief justifications for that is going to be a kind of a liberal justification. Another kind of justification with an entirely different kind of moral lineage would be subsidiarity talk. Here's a third one, communitarian talk.
Right.
And so, I mean, communitarianism is a kind of a political theory that, I guess it has its roots in some ways in like Hegelian political thought, but its more modern location is in the work of like Alistair MacIntyre in After Virtue, which I think he wrote in something like 1980 or 1981, in which he articulated this criticism of liberal political morality that gets taken up. And then that kind of gives birth to a variety of different thinkers who embrace or at least who are attached to kind of this communitarian label. So other important figures that figure there are Charles Taylor, Michael Sandel. Though interestingly, all three of them, MacIntyre, Taylor, and Sandel, end up like abandoning and disavowing the communitarian label. They're all quick to say, no, I'm not a communitarian. But I suppose the idea there communitarian thought proper, you really do get something like an explicit rejection of liberal political morality and the idea that the community and the good of the community is prior to any kind of rights of the individual. So there was a time in like the early 80s in which like the liberal communitarian debate was this big deal, but then in a lot of ways kind of dried up, in part because a lot of people were abandoning the communitarian label for what I think was good reasons, just because it becomes a little bit difficult to articulate the idea that like the good of the community is prior to and totally independent of any kinds of concerns about individuals.
Right.
I don't know if you want to talk about that at all. But anyways, so those are like at least two additional ways of trying to ground or explain the idea of states' rights as a system of political organization that aren't liberal in any way.
Well, and there's, of course, there's the I guess I don't know exactly what you call it, I guess the process way, right? The idea that the structure of the Constitution is such that states have explicit rights, particularly looking at the 10th Amendment, and between the 10th Amendment and the very limited powers granted to the federal government, anything like, you know, solving the water problem in Flint, Michigan, is just not allowed by the Constitution without going through the amendment process.
Uh-huh. I mean, I guess I would just say of that kind of view that, like, that is having a kind of a legal or constitutional debate as opposed to, like, the more foundational moral debate
right.
about the way it should be, right? And so, like, you know, we can have those kinds of conversations. Those are important kinds of conversations. But, like, but the deeper question is, yeah, and is that way of doing things the right way to do things?
You know, I am sort of curious, and I was going to save this question until later, but, you know, I mentioned the 10th Amendment. Edda, what does the 10th Amendment mean to you?
That's not a question that I'm often asked. So the 10th Amendment is the amendment that explicitly defers powers to the states that aren't...
Should I just read it?
Yeah, sure.
So the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution nor prohibited to it, by it to the states are reserved to the states respectively or to the people.
Mm-hmm. This kind of gets to, like, my all things considered take about the nature of states' rights. So, like, I think that's fine. Technically speaking, I'm perfectly happy with the doctrine of states' rights. I think it captures important liberal ideas. I mean, all the liberal ideas that you've been talking about. Equally, in some ways, I could say, like, I'm perfectly happy with the doctrine of subsidiarity. But the problem is that states' rights is usually invoked because some state is trying to justify its violation of other rights and liberties that are possessed by individuals. And then I would just say, but clearly, both constitutionally and morally, it's not entitled to do that. So if you just look at the 10th Amendment, it says that, you know, any powers not delegated to the federal government by the Constitution are reserved to states. And so, like, that's fine. But there are powers that are delegated to the federal government.
Sure.
And there are certain boundaries that limit the actions and behaviors of states.
Let me slightly rephrase my question then. And I think this is basically the same question. Are there any policies that you would like to see implemented that you would agree the federal government does not have the power to do, but the state government does? That it's not legitimate for the federal government to implement, but state governments under, you know, sort of the 10th Amendment or whatever can?
Yeah, I mean, nothing that I particularly am concerned with. And then, you know, I would just say that, like, the kinds of social issues that I'm most animated about, whether they are issues of racial discrimination, you know, whether they're issues of discrimination or inequality, I mean, I think those issues matter precisely because they're the kinds of issues that cannot be addressed by states. Like,
at all, or they cannot be addressed in a way that you like the result.
They cannot successfully be addressed by states. I mean, that's precisely why they become issues
for
the federal
government. But again, successfully
meaning
you don't like the result, or successfully meaning they're not legitimately handled by the states.
I'm not sure if I understand the difference between those two things, but I'm happy to defer to whatever you want me to say.
Well, again, it's this idea of, like, if the reason you're saying, hey, this should be done on the federal level is just, I don't like the decision the states are making. That's not necessarily a legitimate argument, right? That's just, I don't want to lose. If the mm-hmm. reason for saying, no, this should be handled on the federal level is it's legitimately a federal power rather than a state power, right? It's not included in that 10th Amendment thing.
Uh-huh.
Well, then that's a different argument.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's not precluded by the 10th Amendment. So, I mean, so give me an example. Is Social Security a violation of the 10th Amendment?
I think it depends on what you do with what is it, the 16th Amendment, right? The income tax.
Yes.
Right. This question of the federal government being able to apply a tax directly to the American people.
Mm-hmm.
So probably not a violation of the 10th Amendment because we have a 16th Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
Now I would look at something like the minimum wage. And I would say that is a perfectly legitimate state government operation. But the federal government has no legitimate right to set that.
And so the right that the federal government has to regulate the economy.
Yeah. I would say that's an overly expansive view of the Commerce Clause.
Sorry, what exactly does the Commerce Clause say?
The federal that Congress has the right to regulate commerce.
Yeah, I guess. So I don't know if you want to have a knockdown, drag out debate about whether that's an expansive interpretation or not. But if he just has the right to regulate commerce, I mean, that's a pretty simple, broad statement, right? It's not qualified in any way. It's just like this recognition that economies are national by nature. It's just the kind of thing that it is. It's just the kind of thing that it is, right? I mean, the money that we use is issued by the federal government. The spending of any one person in any one part of the country affects the spending of another person in another part of the country insofar as it affects the availability of goods or the nature of inflation and, you know, all of that stuff. Because a bunch of people couldn't afford their mortgages in various parts of the country, that actually affects the price of my house. So I would say that the Commerce Clause in its very sort of simple grammatical form is making a pretty broad statement. And the broad statement that it makes is reflective of the fact that the economy by its nature is a national
thing. So the clause
thing.
Itself says Congress the power to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and with the Indian tribes. And we probably shouldn't have a knockdown drag out over it here. I would just say that is not sort of the superpower of Congress. That itself is a limited power. And again, we can argue about how limited it is or how limited it shouldn't be. But it's not sort of the get out of jail free card for the federal government. At least it shouldn't be. It's sort of been treated that way. But it's not the, oh, well, money is attached to this issue. Therefore, we can pass whatever law we want.
So, you know, I would certainly argue that there are probably instances in which the Commerce Clause is appealed to justify some action of the federal government. And I might say, yeah, no, that's inappropriate. But I wouldn't say that Social Security is an inappropriate use of it. And I wouldn't say that minimum wage laws are inappropriate uses of it.
Right. And again, I'm not saying that I'm against minimum wage or Social Security. I'm just saying, is that legitimate for the federal government to be doing? Right. State governments
yes.
want to do that. Awesome.
And your
power
answer
to
is
them.
No.
Again, I'm not saying minimum wages are inherently bad. I'm just saying if state governments want to do that, power to them, right? Totally legitimate, totally fair game. The federal government, maybe not so much. And I'm not an expert on, you know, the taxing power of the federal government, but sort of my amateur survey of it says, not so much. Which sort of points us back towards that original question of, is there anything that the federal government can't do? I mean, with that interpretation, the answer is no.
But I guess I would say that, I mean, the reason why the federal government takes on certain kinds of responsibilities, I think, whether it is like civil rights and people being denied civil rights in their states, or whether it is issues like Social Security or welfare programs, is that like that just gets at problems that by their nature cannot be addressed by state governments. It's not like these programs just get invented for like no reason at all. Like Social Security arose because the vast majority of older Americans were like living in crushing poverty. States weren't able to address those issues. And so they got, and it's not just that they didn't, like they couldn't, again, given the nature of the way in which an economy works. And so those get picked up by the federal government. And,
right.
And then
the aggressive state rights view is going to say that doesn't mean that the federal government should.
Well, and so you could provide an example of something that you think is prohibited and then we can talk about it. So I certainly think that, yeah, there are issues that go outside the right purview of the federal government. I mean, the federal government wanted to pass a law that said everybody in the country needs to wear red shirts on Friday. I would say that like that goes well above and beyond the powers that are granted to the federal government. And I would also say that you're right. I mean, progressives like me tend to be less sensitive and aware of like issues of federalism, but they don't have to be. And then I would just say that a progressive could sort of acknowledge the importance of federal structure while still being fully progressive in their politics, just because there's this realization that like federal government isn't granted every power, but the kinds of social concerns that animate progressives fall into the category of powers that are explicitly granted to the federal government.
Or at least there's something expansive in the desires of what progressives want, right? This idea that this thing we want should be applied to everyone rather than just limited to my immediate context, my town or my state or what have you. Which isn't to say that conservatives can't also be expansive in their desires. They certainly can be. That's another aspect of small L liberalism that sort of applies to everyone. But I think you maybe see it more explicitly in the in some of the progressive policies. Anything else on this? All of this introductory stuff, Ed?
No, go ahead.
Yeah. So some big issues, kind of practically in history, that have come up in terms of states' rights, nullification, interposition, all of that. That have moved both progressives and conservatives, if we can be anachronistic in our language, in various times and in various ways. Certainly the big original one is taxation. So that American Revolution was in some ways about the idea of who can legitimately tax the colonists. The British government, of course, said, well, we can. And the colonists, especially Patrick Henry, was sort of the big name with this, argued that only colonial legislatures have the right to tax the colonies, since they're the only place the colonists have representation. So again, there's that idea of, I guess, colonies' rights rather than states' rights, but it's still there. And then this economic stream continued. So in the early Republic, there was widespread resistance to the National Bank. In the early 19th century, especially in the North, the idea that Hamilton's bank was creating this national economy, when really that was the job of the states were responsible for maintaining their own economic prosperity. Foreign policy has been a place where you've seen lots of pushback. George Washington was, if I remember right, he was burned in effigy at times for keeping us out of the war between France and England. Again, there's this idea that Washington, the president, not Washington, the city, although eventually Washington, the city, is going to stay neutral, then maybe it's on the states to pick a side and not directly get involved, but at least show moral support, maybe some goods and merchandise and so on to the side they've picked. You see similar outrage again. I think mostly in the North, although our historians can tell me if I'm wrong here. I'm not much of an early 19th century scholar. Over the War of 1812, if I remember right, there's talk of secession as a result of this, especially in Connecticut. I think is where they're talking. This is unjust war, and we want no part of it. And then, of course, the big place where states' rights comes into play is with the question of slavery, and at least in the early days of the debate, this was a states' rights issue all around. So there's the question, of course, in the South of who has the right to decide whether or not slavery will be a legal institution. The South kind of across the board claimed, no, that is a state question, not a question for the federal government. In the North, you also have a practical version of states' rights and nullification, particularly when state laws would be passed intentionally nullifying the Fugitive Slave Act. So again, you have kind of this debate over states' rights going on that eventually gets swamped and drowned out by the Civil War. But at least in the early days, both sides were involved. And then anything on that 19th century stuff, Ed? I don't think any of us are either of us are scholars of the 19th century America.
No, go ahead.
Yeah, so the mid-20th century, civil rights issues are again states' rights questions, Jim Crow laws and so on in the South, become sort of the big question of, well, who has the right to define things like access to the polls? Is that a question that the federal government can answer, or is that a question best left to the states? And again, the South largely said this is best left to the states. North, I guess I don't know enough about the North in the 1960s to know if they were actively on the side of this is a national question, or if they also agreed, no, this is a states' rights question, but you Southerners are wrong. I don't know. And then the other place you see states' rights really argued in the 20th century, in the mid 20th century, is with the issue of environmentalism, especially in the 70s and the 80s. As the environmental movement takes off, you see states setting their own environmental standards. In contrast to the EPA is not quite the right way to put it, above and beyond whatever standards the EPA sets, even in conflict with other state actions, in conflict with states around them. This, if I remember right, this is called the California effect. The idea is that a state sets very, very high environmental regulations, and that flows into the states around them and raises all sorts of questions about the interactions between states. And then, of course, you have the other side of that. Once the EPA sort of really gets up and running, and starts passing regulations that states don't like, and then you have states working to undermine the EPA again from this perspective of states' rights issues. So you have this weird kind of states' rights pro-environment, states' rights anti-environment going on at the same time in the 20th century, and now, of course, into the 21st century. And then today, the two big issues that people mostly talk about in terms of states' rights are marijuana and immigration. So we functionally have nullification going on in both of these places, right? So Colorado, California, I'm sure there are other states, but those are the ones I see in the news all the time, have for all intents and purposes nullified federal drug law. Individual cities have taken similar actions when it comes to immigration, declaring themselves sanctuary cities and so on. Did I miss anything big in there, Ed?
No, I mean, those are certainly the issues, and those are issues in which the states, I mean, especially the contemporary issues of marijuana legalization and immigration, those are issues in which the states' rights concerns gets flipped a little bit, and you can see liberals embracing them.
All right. Well, I think that's all I had, Ed. What else do you have about states' rights?
Yeah, I just had these more kind of fundamental kinds of questions in a lot of ways. So, like, you'll often talk about states' rights or talk about issues of what the Constitution does and doesn't prohibit. I mean, we've talked about those things already today. But then in a lot of ways, like, the issues that interest me most are, like, the more fundamental normative issues. Like, why is this a good view? Like, why is it a good thing that the Constitution says that? Should the Constitution say that? Or should we endeavor to, like, add amendments to change what the Constitution says, like these more fundamental normative issues. And like when you talk about the issue, it kind of sounds like the normative ideals to which you appeal to justify and explain this idea of states' rights tends to be liberal in its language.
Yeah, and I'll even double down on the liberalism here. I'll say that it is liberal in its language, and one of the reasons that it is kind of normatively good, like one of the reasons that I do tend to think that states' rights are a good idea is because of the value of diversity. So to really go full liberal here, I think states' rights are good because I think diversity is an important thing. That is, I think it is better to have, particularly in a nation of 300 million people, rather than a one size fits all, everyone has to do exactly the same thing at all times and all places, a diversity of at least 50 different governments doing 50 different things, each according to what is appropriate in their own time and place, and what is most in line with the will of the citizens of their state.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, that is liberal, sort of small L liberalism at work. And that means sometimes some states have bad government, right? That means sometimes states do things that are wrong. And just as it's good to celebrate when they do things that are good, it's right to point out when states do things that are wrong. But it's also important to protect their integrity and their ability to make those mistakes. I talk about this in class a little bit. When we talk about education, it used to be, and I assume this is still the case, although I haven't checked the stats, Mississippi was sort of infamous as the state with the worst education in the country, right? I mean, mm-hmm. I don't know if that's still the case or not, but my point is always, Mississippi is number 50, and that's unfortunate for the people in Mississippi, but that also means that we have 49 states that aren't the worst in the country. We have, 49 states you could live in and get a better education than the worst place in the country. If we only had, one national school system the way many other liberal nations do, then our educational system is only as good as whatever that one national school system is. So you have the chance to be in a better system. You have the chance to be in a better state. That goes away if everything is determined from the central government. Again, I think that diversity is just essential.
Yeah. So, and then I guess I would say diversity, big thumbs up, like diversity a lot, but there are limits to the diversity. There are limits to the diversity that we want. Right. We don't want to sort of look at all 50 states and be like, hey, you know, of all the 50 states, we don't have a racist state. So we want to have a racist state because that makes us more diverse, right?
Well, again, I think there are limits, there are limits that are clearly, I think, defined in the Constitution, and maybe there are limits that should be added. But there are times when I think it's important to say, look, I don't like what this state is doing. So if we were to have a state, and I'm sure this is in some state legislature somewhere, but if we were to have a state that says we're going to allow we've had this discussion, right? Trans individuals to pick the bathroom of their choice. I would say I disagree with what that law, mm-hmm. the state is passing, but they have the right to pass it. Right? I don't agree with what they're doing, but that's neither really here nor there when it comes to their authority to make that decision.
Yeah. So I guess I would say this about all of that states' rights talk. I mean, I think there's a way in which, it's a very unstable view to get the view that you want to get to. And it's unstable for this reason. At least as you've been defending it, it's a liberal view. And if it's a liberal view, then that means it's sort of identifying that human beings have these fundamental rights that deserve respect and that are enshrined in, right. In documents like the Bill of Rights, right? And then it says, among these rights is, let's say states' rights, the rights to live in communities that have a degree of political autonomy unto themselves. And then I, as a liberal, say, yeah, that's great. That's really fine. This is getting back to the early discussion that we have. But then, even I, as a liberal, would say, that's great. States' rights. I'm totally fine with states' rights. But in identifying states' rights and using liberal rights talk to justify the idea that there are states' rights is also necessarily then to recognize that there are these other rights that deserve to be respected. And then, when these rights come into conflict, so states have rights, that's fine, but states don't have the right to violate other rights, right? And then usually, doctrine of states' rights arises precisely because I would say states are trying to justify the violation of the rights of citizens living within their borders, right? And so, historically, states' rights talk is associated with both the Civil War and the right for people to own slaves. And it's associated with debates about the civil rights movements in the 50s and 60s and the rights of states to discriminate against African-American persons. And then to me, it's just really clear that they don't have those rights. So we can talk about states' rights, but they don't have those rights, right?
Yeah. And again, I think that's where the Constitution, so the federal Constitution, is kind of the place to go for what are the things that states cannot do, right? What are the list of things that they're not allowed to do? So states are not allowed, for example, to grant titles of nobility. States are not allowed to treat the citizens from other states differently than they treat their own citizens. States are not allowed to legalize slavery. So think sort of 13th Amendment. States are required to respect due process when it comes to basically all citizens within their own state. 14th Amendment. And I mean we could come up with a list of things that states are not allowed to do. Restrictions on state power. And we could argue as to whether or not that there are other things that should be added to that list. There probably are. It's not something I'm necessarily prepared for this episode, but we could say, yeah, there are things that maybe ought to be added to that list. But we should also recognize that it is a somewhat finite list, right? And to some extent, some of the interpretation of what those limitations are should be left to the states, right? So what does it mean to say a state is going to recognize? What does it mean to say that a state is going to recognize the documents from another state? Well, again, to pick on this transgendered thing, if a person decides that he is a gender other than his biological gender, and I know I might be using the pronouns there, but I can never remember how you're supposed to use those pronouns. What does that mean if that individual moves to a state where the state has said, yeah, we're recognizing the biological birth, that's your gender, right? What does that mean functionally? What has to be on the birth certificate? What goes on the driver's license? Those are limitations that are placed on the state that have to be interpreted that maybe ought to be worked out by the states, if that makes sense.
I want to come to the, I mean, we've talked about the transgender issue. I want to come to that in a second. Do states have the right to discriminate against Black people?
No. Again, I think that's pretty clearly a due process kind of 14th Amendment thing.
So, yeah. And do states have the right to discriminate against people on the basis of religion?
In general, so here's where I'll show my my strict constructionist colors. I think the answer is no, but I also think that is generally protected by state constitutions rather than by the federal constitution. So most state constitutions provide for freedom of religion. I don't know of any that don't, although there's 50 state constitutions out there, so there may very well be one.
Okay, so that's fine. So that's all. So all of which is to say that, like, there are obviously limits to states' power.
And, yes.
And then I would say,
or I would say there are things that states cannot do, but limits to states' power. Again, states, as I said at the beginning, states have plenary power. That is, they can do anything they are not forbidden to do.
Yeah. Well, so that's fine. And so among the things that they are forbidden to do are to violate rights that are explicitly guaranteed by the United States Constitution.
Right, so charge a tax to vote, right? I mean, that would be an explicit violation of the Constitution.
So when we're understanding the doctrine of states' rights, we're recognizing that there are explicit limits to what states can and can't do. I mean, outside of those limits, they can do whatever they want, but that we're also recognizing that there's a role for federal government and there's certain kinds of things that states can and can't do. And then I would just say that, like, and then we got to have debates about these things, about whether these things fall within the purview of things that states can and can't do, right? So, like, I mean, with regard to states' rights or even with regard to subsidiarity talk, like, I'm perfectly happy to talk about those things. Like, in that way, I'm a states' rights theorist, or in that way, I'm a subsidiarity theorist. But, like, oftentimes I think the tendency is to, like, fail to recognize that under both of those doctrines, however you understand the formulation of the doctrine of states' rights, like, there is a place for the federal government to do things, either to draw limits on what states can do or to pick up responsibilities on subsidiarity talk for things that states fail to do. And then we can have a debate about whether the state is doing something that it's actually prohibited from doing. So in some ways, it's actually not so much a debate about states' rights. It's a debate about what the limits of states' rights is. And then I would say, yeah, and then we have to have a case-by-case conversation about whether a state is engaging in action that it is forbidden from doing.
Although that's turning it around from the way states' rights people would normally talk about it, right? Normally they would say, actually, this is a limitation on the federal government. Raising the question of whether the feds can go that far and whether they've gone too far and so on.
That's fine. And so we could have the conversation in that direction as well. But I guess the point that I want to get to is that if you're a states' rights theorist, you're a liberal theorist. And so you are recognizing that there are intrinsic limits on what states can do to people. And so, you know, whether you want to get to it through the front door or through the back door, that's fine. But then just merely saying states' rights, states' rights, states' rights, that doesn't settle the issue. We got to talk about whether this specific thing falls within the purview of what states can and can't do.
Right. Well, and I'll go ahead and say that most of the time, assuming you're not talking an explicit violation of the Constitution, states can do it. Right. Again, there's that deference to state governments can do this thing if they choose to, which is why I'm hesitant to turn the conversation around, because the question is usually, can the federal government also do it? And that's where the states' rights crowd and progressives are going to separate, is often the states' rights crowd are going to say, no, they can't. That's a state issue, even if the states choose not to.
That's fine. That's fine with me. You know, so I don't have a super strong view about education. And I don't know a lot about how education law works, but part of it has to do with the fact it's not like state is mandating certain kinds of standards that it's not like the federal government is mandating certain kinds of standards that states need to adhere to, right? It's more about here's some federal money if you want it, but if you want it, there are strings right. attached.
Yeah.
And then states take the money.
And that's honestly a large portion of kind of the decline of, you know, state influence and state power and so on, and the growth of federal government is through this money that comes from the federal government that comes with these strings attached, and states are never obligated to take that money.
Course
they usually do, and that's problematic for the states. I would love to see states start, you know, rejecting federal money for things like schools and Social Security and Medicaid and Medicare, or Medicaid and Medicare, not Social Security, because that's a federal program. But I wouldn't mind seeing states start turning that stuff down at all.
That's right. But you can't also say that the federal government passing those laws violates the Constitution.
Well, and you also can't say to your individual citizens, we're not taking this money, therefore pay less in federal taxes. And that's sort of the catch-22, is your citizens are being taxed whether you use the money or not. So there's not really an out for states when it comes to that.
Yeah, sure. But the question of taxation is, that's already been established, right? We know that the federal government can tax.
But again, I'm just saying, you know, what is the incentive for the state not to take the federal money when their citizens are contributing into the pool anyway? I mean, I guess the incentive is if you don't take the money, you don't have to follow the regulations. So in that case, it depends on the regulation, which of course the big thing these days is being anti-Common Core, right? I don't know if your Facebook feed fills up as much as mine does every time there's a school board election with just vitriol against Common Core. But you know, it's important to remember it's a voluntary program that 46 states signed up for. It's an educational atrocity, and I would love nothing more than to see it die, but you got to not take the money.
Why do you think it's an educational atrocity?
Sorry, I'm trying to decide if I want to get started on this.
Fine. We can have a Common Core episode. I mean, I'm no particular fan of Common Core, but I live in a Common Core state.
Well, we all live in Common Core states.
And there are certain ways.
Unless you're in those four. Yeah.
46. I don't know what the four states are. But anyways, like, there are times in which I look at what my son or daughter is doing and I'm kind of like, huh, we didn't do it that way. And that's a little confusing to me.
Right.
But usually it's more the case of like, holy cow, I never did that when I was Hannah's age.
Right.
She's getting a much better education than I did when I was her age. And really so much of it has to do with like the role that states played in training their teachers. And it's really clear that states that did a better job in preparing their teachers and in training everybody, like, they're doing a really good job. Like, when we were in Louisiana, the teachers weren't on board with it. And so that just created a lot of – I mean, that was just, like, the worst situation. But that's largely because, like, the state of Louisiana just did such a lousy job of getting everybody ready for it. Here in California – I mean, the parents were kind of leery about the Common Core, but the really striking thing was that the teachers were all like, no, we understand that, you know, we understand that there was a reach, but this is really, really awesome. We're really excited about this. This is really going to benefit your kids.
And it's a style of teaching that is aimed at a generation that is raised with visual media instead of with sort of the written word. And obviously there are good reasons to do it that way, given what's going on in American culture today.
I don't know if that's a part of it, but I don't know that gets at the heart. I mean, the root of a lot of it is it's trying to provide kids different cognitive strategies for understanding, at least with regard to math, different cognitive strategies for understanding mathematical concepts.
Yeah, we'll do an education episode when I will unload on the modern education system and how terrible it is.
We can get Nick back on for that. But anyways, I mean, we're straying from the conversation about states' rights. And then again, like, just my big point is that, like, it's a liberal view, perfectly happy to affirm it. But as a liberal view, there are liberal limits on what states can do. And then I would say we can have a conversation on a case by case basis about why this is or isn't a violation of federal authority. So, like, on the education thing that you were just complaining about, like, that's just not an issue. Like, that isn't an issue of federalism. Like, you can't talk about states' rights and talk about education because there is no violation of states' rights. And, like, we've talked about the transgender issue before. I mean, I do think it's complicated in certain kinds of ways. But just to push the traditional liberal line, which I'm 80 or 90%, like, I would say that, yeah, that's among the things that states can't do. Like, why are you so eager to be able to discriminate against persons who understand their gender differently than you do? Like, why shouldn't people just be allowed to make their own decisions about how they understand their gender identity?
Right.
And, like, and you know what my substantive theological views are about this. So this isn't even like a substantive moral question. It's a question about allowing people to pursue their own conception of the good in an unhindered way. And, like, you might not like it, but, like, that's the whole point of rights talk, right? Rights provide limits and allow people to pursue their own conception of the good free from external interference.
So if I remember our bathrooms and wedding cakes episode, my objection was, of course, I have the sort of traditional Christian view of sexuality, but my political objection was not as much to that as it was to the question of whether or not it was a violation of states' rights for the president, then Obama, to decree that, you know, basically every school in the country now had to recognize this thing. Mm-hmm. So even with the idea that, hey, they've taken federal money, so, you know, they have to go along with the strings, I would still say that's not playing fair, because that was not an original condition of the money when it was given. That is a new string that's been added. And in that case, I'm happy to say, no, look, this is a states' rights question at this point. If you want to add that as a string, you need to wait until the next budget cycle, add that on as a string, and give states the option of saying no, rather than just sort of imperiously declaring it, and everyone has to obey or else, which is no longer an issue because that letter is now dead. But I think was a pretty solidly clear states' rights question, where you have the federal government overstepping agreed upon boundaries that both sides had already agreed on, and now saying, "Oh, just kidding, we're moving the boundary." So that, again, without getting into the nuts and bolts of biology and psychology and so on, that's a states' rights issue, I think, hands down.
Well, we've talked about this. I guess I would just say again that there are rules and procedures in which these things are adjudicated. The executive branch has the constitutional authority to administer the various different departments of education. Then we can have a debate about whether any particular instance of that adjudication is within the terms of the law. And then when we have debates, courts rule. So, like, that's that. But you're right. Like, at the end of the day, it's a null issue. So, I mean, the process kind of worked itself out and we came to a resolution. That's fine. On the water issue, I would say this obsessive concern with preserving state sovereignty, even in the face of, like, massive human suffering, like, I just don't get that. And so, like, this gets back to that point that we were making about, like, the water issue, the hypothetical water issue in Detroit. So again, let's just say that Detroit cannot address the issue on its own. And so the federal government steps in to remediate that. Your point was that it doesn't necessarily have the authority to do that. And I guess what I don't understand is, like, so, like, explain to me the moral calculus in which the preservation of that very abstract kind of states' rights doctrine outweighs concerns about like the physical health and welfare of individual citizens. Like, I just don't get that.
Well, it's not an abstract line, right? It's a real world line. You now have the federal government crossing an agreed upon line, wherein, you know, local governments or state governments, depending on where you're at, are responsible for things like care of their own citizens and keeping clean water and doing all of those sorts of things. So to have the federal government step over that line is changing the rules. And again, even if we like the result this time, even if it, you know, means clean drinking water for Flint, you know, now the rules have been changed and we may not like it next time. Right. What begins with the federal government providing, you know, additional funding for state education ends with, you know, my kids having to share a bathroom and a locker room with kids of the opposite gender, regardless of, you know, any decision by the local school board, any decision by the state board of education, any decision by me as a parent. It just obliterates that division. And in doing so, obliterates the sovereignty of the local government, the sovereignty of the state, our freedom as a community to make these decisions ourselves, just as if some foreign nation were to come in and you know, decree to us that, you know, we have to obey this policy, even if we don't want to, and we have to do it because, you know, they helped us in the past, which I recognize the irony of the United States does this sort of thing fairly regularly. And I'm happy to have a foreign policy episode. But I think those lines, they're not just abstractions. They're real world practical lines that matter. I think they're important to preserve because, by and large, most of our authority as individuals to use our liberalism language, most of our authority as individuals, most of our freedom as individuals, is something that happens on the local and state level. I'm always going to have more influence in my local government and in my state government than I am on the federal level. And if I think things like the ability of the individual to influence government are important, then those local and state governments need to be protected. They need to be preserved against intrusion from the national government.
What's so horrible about your kids sharing a locker room or a bathroom with someone who was born a girl but identifies as a boy?
You'd be okay with a guy sharing a locker room with your daughter, Ed? You'd be comfortable with that?
Why wouldn't I be?
I mean, often fathers are incredibly protective of their daughters. I assume that you are too.
And so what is the threat that my daughter is under when there is another teenage child who identifies as a girl who's changing next to her?
I mean, you don't think there are teenagers who will take advantage of that if the opportunity arises?
That's one thing, but
it seems like a pretty big thing.
Look, but it's really easy enough for institutions to deal with cases like that. I'm not talking about that. That's easy. I mean, we're talking about people who are identifying with the opposite gender. You're not going to have knucklehead teenagers who are going to totally go through the process of like identifying with the other gender and identifying themselves in official ways in that way, just so that they can sneak into the girls' locker.
And again, we don't have to get into the nuts and bolts of that debate. My point is, shouldn't you be the person making that decision for your daughter?
What's so awful about that?
Ed, shouldn't you be the one making that decision? Or at least your community, your school, maybe your state is sort of the biggest, right? Shouldn't you be the person?
Making a decision about the gender identification of another human being.
You should be making the decision about the policy that will affect the school where your daughter attends. Just like I should be making the decision, or at least have a major say in it. Again, this is back on that sovereignty and legitimacy stuff, right? I have proportionally more influence based on the size of the community I'm speaking into.
So horrible about your son sharing a locker room with somebody who was born a girl but who identifies as a boy? Like, what's so horrible about that?
I don't want to get into the nuts and bolts of that. I want to ask, why is it okay that you get to make that decision and I don't?
I think more than anything else, the thing that really animates these states' rights debates is that people are just freaked out by people who are other and different than them.
No. Look, Ed, my objection here is that you're claiming the right to make that decision for my kid. That's my problem.
You're claiming the right to make a decision about
What, no, how no, you, the, you go to your school board and you argue for whatever you want in your school. I don't, I mean, I think there's a right answer and a wrong answer, but whatever your school board decides, that's fine. Knock yourselves
well, what's
out.
What's the right answer?
You want to go and say that, hey, there should just be one giant locker room for everyone. I don't care. That's your school board. Make
no,
the decision.
It's not.
But I want to have the same right to make that choice in my community. Why will you not grant that to me?
Because you're attempting to violate the rights of another human being.
You're attempting to violate the rights of my community to make that decision.
So there we go. Like, so that's the rights conflict. And now we can have a conversation about why the right of the community should trump the right of an individual in that way, right? Which is exactly the conversation that people had in the civil rights era.
So just to clarify here, you would be okay if the Trump administration sent out a memo to all schools saying biological gender is the bathroom you use. We're decreeing this. Totally comfortable with that. Even if you disagree with the substance, you're fine with that exercise of power.
Well, but the problem with the decree is that it violates people's rights. That's why I'm against it. And we've already decided
this is
that
sort
people
of
have
a,
rights.
This is kind of a no matter what, you win and I lose. Like that's sort of the substance of this.
Well, insofar as there's a real right that's at stake, but we've already decided that rights are real things and that they provide spheres of moral protection.
We have, and I've not granted
people.
You this as a right,
that's just
but I'm also
right
leaving
is.
This sort of abstract. Because again, the question is who gets to decide that? Who gets to decide this sort of policy? I'm saying, yeah, bathrooms clearly are not in the Constitution. It's not voting. It's not due process or it's not it's not nobility. It's not the various things that are specifically forbidden. So that interpretation needs to fall on the place where everything else is reserved to as per the 10th Amendment.
And then I say that states can never do anything. Like states have power and authority. That's fine. But they don't have the right to violate other people's rights. And this is just a rights debate, right? But again, the thing that really motivates it is like this desire for people just like to not be around things that like freak them out. And like, you don't have the right not to be around stuff that freaks you out.
Oh, I agree with like, that. I totally agree with that.
So on the bathroom issue, like why is that so concerning for you?
Well, again, my issue is who is making the decision. Right. So my issue is at what level is this decision being made? Is it being made in Washington, D.C., in a place where I have no influence and no say whatsoever? Or is it being made in my state, in my local school board, in my county, in some level of government where I can speak up and have a voice? I mean, can you not see the distinction there?
Yeah. But look, would you be making the same argument if we were talking about civil rights for African Americans?
Yeah. So I'm going to deny that connection just as I did during the bathrooms and wedding cakes episode. I'm going to say those are different questions. Race and gender are not quite the same thing. But in one sense, I'm going to say it depends on the nature of the discussion in question. Right. So, I might say something like, let me think about how I want to phrase this example. I might say something like an affirmative action program is a program where I can say, look, this is drawing a distinction between peoples of color, and it's drawing a distinction that has to do with employment, that's obviously deeply important, and that is a decision. That's a program that needs to be decided at the state level, right? That's a program that is best left to local and state governments. That is a question of states' rights. I'm actually really comfortable saying that. So yes, depending on the nature of the right, I guess, the quote unquote right in question, because I don't know that you have a right to affirmative action. But if there is going to be affirmative action, yeah, I'm happy with leaving that on the state level.
So I mean, this is so. First of all, I totally agree. Race and gender are different things. The historical circumstances of African Americans is way, way different than the historical circumstances of transgender persons. Totally happy to say that. But the point, obviously, that I'm trying to get at is just this. If it's a right issue, there is no debate about state sovereignty, local control. Like states, local citizens do not have the right, even if they want to, even if they decide to, they do not have the right to trample on the rights of other people, right?
Yes. Though I think we might disagree as to what your rights are.
So all of this talk about like local control, et cetera, is moot if there are rights debates that are at stake.
Right. So again, if we're talking about, you know, stripping trans people of the vote, absolutely. Right. That in that case, that is one of the places where states are clearly limited in what they can do.
But like, I mean, this transgender thing, it's just, it's such a stalking horse. Like, why do people care about this? It's because they're just sort of freaked out by stuff. The states' rights discussion is what it is. But the thing why it gets a grip on people is precisely because people are sort of freaked out by, they're freaked out about having to use the same bathroom as black people. So they invoke states' rights talk. They're freaked out about having to share the same bathroom.
Yeah, you keep saying that. I'm just not going to engage that.
I mean, the very idea.
I mean, if you want to talk about being freaked out, maybe we should start letting Baptist preachers go into schools and preach hellfire and brimstone to the children. And pretty quickly, we'd hear about, you know, not letting children get freaked out by people they're uncomfortable with.
Well, but that's a different issue, because there it's an issue of a state sort of explicitly advocating for a particular religious
view. Yeah, which again, I don't want to get too hung up in the Constitution. I am fine with states doing that. I mean, as a Baptist, I'm not okay with it, but sort of constitutionally, I have no objection. But that's a rabbit trail.
So disestablishment is all I'm going to say. But look, I mean, like, the point of it all is like to talk about rights. Is to talk about states' rights is to talk about rights. And then you can't pick and choose the rights that you want to recognize. They are what they are. And so there's no point in invoking talk about states' rights talk if like you're talking about the state discriminating and violating the rights of other people. There just like is no conversation about that. Like all of that talk is fine. State sovereignty, local control, like all of that is fine and valuable. But it's just off the table if you're talking
right.
about
with the understanding that rights are not necessarily whatever one side happens to decree them to be.
Sure.
Right. And that's why I'm going to want to sort of hold close to the text of the Constitution as these are the things that we have clearly outlined. Maybe there should be more, right? Maybe there ought to be an amendment to the Constitution, you know, protecting trans people and letting them use whatever bathroom they want to use. Fine. That's not in the Constitution right now. So until then, there are specific limits on states. That does not appear to be one of them. So the state gets to decide that particular issue, which again is not taking a stand on the substance of it. It's taking a stand on how do we make this decision, and that falls on the state.
Yeah, on the transgender issue, on the Detroit water issue. There you have, I mean, on the water issue, like there just is no, I'm having a hard time understanding why the sacrifice of local autonomy on an issue that they can't address is a kind of moral concern that compares in any way to like the harm that is being done to individuals that can be remediated. And I just sort of feel like in all of these conversations, there's a failure to sort of recognize the harm and suffering or rights violation of persons that's like sacrificed in the name of states' rights.
Right. And I think what it comes down to is I'm unwilling to say, look, we've all agreed to this set of rules that we're going to follow. But in this circumstance, things are so important, so dire that we're just going to break our own rules. And we're going to go in and do this thing that needs to be done. And everything will go back to the way it was. Well, it never goes back to the way it was. I am guilty of this in sort of my own intellectual past as well. Back in the early 2000s, when the war on terror started, I was one of the defenders of the Patriot Act. In retrospect, I would look at that and I'd say, no, that was a bad idea. Yes. In the wake of September 11th, we were all sort of worked up and we all had this idea that the government needs to do something right now. We have this Constitution, but it's okay if we sort of half set it aside to deal with these exigent circumstances. Now looking back, I'm like, man, I was just an idiot. That was not at all. Like we play by the rules, even when things we don't like are happening, or we change the rules within the rules, right? If you want to add an amendment that says that when there is a dire local circumstance, the federal government needs to intervene, fine. We can have that discussion. Until such an amendment is added, no. No, we don't get to just make up stuff because we want to do it at any given moment, even if there is a good moral reason for doing so.
So I guess I would just say, like, the assumption running through that is that, like, the provision of water is, like, something that violates a power that is not explicitly granted towards states.
It doesn't have to be explicitly granted towards states. It has to be explicitly granted towards the federal government.
Explicitly granted towards the federal government. Right. Like, the federal government isn't doing anything that violates the constitutional.
Which again brings back that question of, is there anything you think the federal government can't do? I mean, if they can provide is there anything they can't do?
Yeah, so the answer is there are lots of things that it can't do. And then we can, if you want, you can suggest something and we can have a debate about it. But in some ways, the bigger issue, the really big issue that I wanted to get at in all of this was, like, there's, like, I think this fundamentally arises out of, like, concerns and reactions to, like, modernity, basically, as a kind of a cultural force in the increasingly modern world, like, that we live in. And I do think that there's a way in which, like, states' rights talk, and this is the way in which it's genuinely conservative, states' rights talk kind of is almost a kind of a romantic view. I don't know if you would disagree with that characterization, but a kind of a romantic pre-modern view about the way things are or should be. Would you disagree with that characterization?
I mean, I would agree with it, but for different reasons. I would say that it is romantic in that after, you know, functionally a century of neglect, state governments are mostly just in shambles. So to talk about states' rights and say I want the state to do these things is assuming that state governments are in better shape than they actually are in reality. Now, that's not an endorsement of the federal government necessarily. It's just to say that it tends to be in a little bit better shape because so much more attention is paid to it and so much more time and effort and thought and so on goes into it. So it's romantic, but it's not romantic because it's, you know, somehow not reflective of the way our governing system is supposed to work. It's romantic because of kind of the reality on the ground.
I guess what I meant was the whole vision of social and political life is romantic. You know, so you mentioned Hamilton early on, just in passing. But, like, I mean, these debates that were happening between federalism and states' rights are, like, debates that, I mean, they're there at the founding, right? It's the debate between Jefferson and Hamilton, which everybody knows about these days, right, because of the musical. But,
right.
I mean, you know, so you have Hamilton, the Federalist, the modernists arguing for, like, you know, these modern bureaucratic institutions to manage our social life over and against Jefferson, like the agrarian, with this romantic view about social and political life. The vision, it's like the total vision itself is kind of wants to harken back to, like, these romantic pre-modern times.
Or to throw in a third player, it's the states' rights folks agree with Adams, who shares kind of Hamilton's ideas, John Adams, not the other Adamses, but, you know, shares some of Hamilton's ideas of professional government and organization and so on, but agrees with Jefferson that these ought mostly to be handled locally. He certainly has more of a robust view of the federal government than Jefferson does, but not nearly as much as Hamilton does. So I'll take the middle ground on that one.
Okay. Well, I mean, maybe you're going to want to resist, like, that characterization. I mean, certainly, I think among states' rights advocates, there's a little bit more of a willingness to sort of embrace that sort of more romantic pre-modern vision.
Oh, sure.
And you know, and then you get a picture of sort of states' rights that really is clearly different from, like, this liberal kind of a justification. But it's just like, I think all of these debates, I think, sort of they run back into, like, reactions to the stress and strains, the possibilities and costs of living in a modern world, you know, and that modernity as this kind of cultural revolution that happened, you know, in the 16th and 17th centuries, creating a whole different set of cultural ideals and values from that of earlier ages. And like that engenders all kinds of amazing possibilities, right? And so like, I mean, well, the recognition of liberal rights for one thing, and then technology and science and all of that stuff. But like, in order to live in that modern world, whatever its costs might be, it's like you need to have modern political institutions.
Yeah, and again, I don't disagree. I'm just willing to say that those should primarily be at the state level rather than at the national level.
But yeah, and then I guess I would just say that like that very distinction in some ways is a little bit anti-modern, just because.
I mean, in that not many people today hold it. Yes.
No. I mean, like in the sense that like the whole tenor of modernity, like one of the real characteristics of modernity is that it's about consolidation and bureaucratic organization. But like, I mean, if you're always sort of keeping things and nationalization and indeed globalization, right. Like if you're always keeping things at like this intensely local level, then I mean, you just don't get modern economy of scales and efficiencies. You don't get industrialization. You don't really get scientific progress. Like those are all hallmarks of modernity, and modernity works precisely through consolidation and bureaucratization. Like it's the whole deal between that distinction between Gemeinschaft and Gesellschaft, right?
Right.
You made that attorneys? Is that like the social theorist who made that distinction?
You know, I honestly don't remember those modern thinkers, you know. Yeah, and again, I am not anti-modern in that I'm necessarily against any of the stuff you just mentioned. I am, you know, centralization and bureaucratization and so on. My point is just that ought to be handled by the state rather than by the federal government in our nation, right? So again, if we're talking English politics or French politics or whatever, totally different issue, right? Totally different discussion. But in our nation, well, modernization, I guess, for lack of a better word, is something that should be handled by the governments that were intentionally given the power to handle it for the reasons that we talked about earlier, you know, good liberal reasons like diversity and sovereignty and legitimacy and so on.
Yeah, but I mean, that very distinction itself is kind of anti-modern.
Well, and to go back right. to the beginning of this very, very long episode, sorry, listeners, along with that is what I sort of said at the beginning. Like the farther away you get from these smaller levels of government, the more those traditional liberal distinctions, those traditional liberal ideas like legitimacy and like sovereignty, have to be supplemented by force. And again, that is yet another aspect of modernity that can't be denied. With the rise of the national bureaucratic state has come this idea of compelling obedience rather than assuming a sort of loyalty on the part of the citizens because of the closeness to the state. And that's a legitimate cost that has been paid and something that I think a more robust view of states' rights would offset some of that cost. There would certainly be cost to it, but again, that might be those costs might be worth paying.
Yeah. So that's an interesting point. It's a really interesting point. I guess I just don't know that it's true that our loyalties to nation get necessarily get weaker on expansion of federal authority. I mean, the federal government isn't substantially larger. I mean, it's smaller, in fact, than it was in the 50s and 60s and 70s. But it's not like people in the 50s and 60s and 70s thought of themselves as like Virginians and not Americans, and that their primary allegiance was to like the state of Virginia. I mean, that might have been the case in the 19th century, but it certainly wasn't.
Oh, sure. And this is modernity in the sort of the big sense, right? Going back to the late 19th century. So starting with the progressive movement in the United States, starting with the organization of nations in Europe in the late 19th century. So, yeah, big view of modernity, not just New Deal on.
Yeah. Yeah. In any case, you're right. We've been going a lot longer than I thought.
We should. I'm going to need to go.
So, Coyle, do you have any parting thoughts for us?
No, I think I got them all out there while we were over the course of the episode.
Okay. If that's the case, then let me thank everybody for listening. The City of Man podcast is a member of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filipic. Learn more about the other shows in the network at christianhumanist.org. If you enjoyed our show, please leave us a review at iTunes and subscribe. To get in touch with us or to offer us comments or ideas about the show, please email us at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. Even better, like our Facebook page at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast. That's the best way to get in touch with us, and we often continue conversations there. We appreciate everyone for listening, and let me remind everyone to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and to render unto God those things that are God's. Thanks for listening.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway.